Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. So we now have more than 14% unemployment, the largest number since the Great Depression. More than 75,000 Americans have now died from the coronavirus. And of course, the president is on Fox and Friends, and he is tweeting. Those of you that were expecting any sort of empathy or any sort of humility, you just haven't been paying attention. Great piece in the Bulwark on Friday by our friend Tim Miller, Orange Man is Bad. And I want to talk about that. So Tim joins me from the left coast this morning. How are you, Tim?
Charlie, it's just always a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, so right before we started this, I said anything that you're probably obsessed with, I'm obsessed with. And this is kind of a great minds think alike, because when I was thinking about my newsletter today, I was going to write about American cacistocracy. I can say that, cacistocracy. You know the phrase? We need to bring
it back. That's right. It was kind of a hot thing in 2017 to have various different ocracies. I remember this.
But this is a good one. And it was Norm Ornstein who first described, you know, the Trump presidency as this American cacistocracy. And that's actually an old 17th century phrase. And it comes from the Greek word. And literally means government by the worst and the most unscrupulous people among us. I mean, the most inept, most cringeworthy kind of government. And you think about all the things that are going on, you know, whether it's, you know, Bill Barr's DOJ soiling itself on the Flynn case, the inept and corrupt bungling of the pandemic, the, you know, pratfalls of the various fail sons or fail son-in-laws, the appointment of the internet troll as a press secretary. I mean, you just keep going on, you know, the treatment of the watchdogs and the whistleblowers, the appointment of this absurdly unqualified hack as director of national intelligence. I think it's time to bring back cacistocracy. But the reason I think you and I were thinking along the same things is, you know, there is this point that you reach with Trump where you go, what else is there to say? And you know that there's some criticism out there that never Trumpers write the same columns over and over again. And you know what? There's a little bit of truth to that, because there is a certain repetitious quality about it, because Trump himself never changes. He just sort of expresses his deep awfulness in these kaleidoscopic ways, which then brought me this one. Then I open up the Bulwark today, and you're writing, actually, the Orange Man is bad, which is like, guys,
shut up and play the hits.
Yeah, play the hits. He is the con man. He is the liar. He is the narcissist. And every story is sort of a variation of that. It just doesn't change, does it?
It does not. And, you know, I was glad you brought up cacistocracy. Like you said, we're really vibing this morning, Charlie, because that is something that has dulled over time. You know, and I wrote about this a little bit in the article, is that you do just start to, you kind of, the badness just starts to kind of envelop you and feel just kind of normal in a lot of ways. You know, kind of humans have this great sense for adaptation. And there were two things that you said there that I didn't write about, but, you know, that are on the theme. And one is that, like, because I and you somewhat, but since I like lived in DC and lived amongst these people, like Jim Swift did, our producer, like, I feel like I really, really, in a personal way, understood the term cacistocracy when it first was brought out, and it really touched a place deep within inside me, because I was like, these literally are the worst people that I know, who have very, very prominent jobs in this White House. And it was alarming for a while, but then you kind of get used to it. And it is good to be reminded of that, and kind of in a more tragic sense, you know, when you did the thing that we do now, and I did this at the top of my article, which is, you know, amidst 30 million unemployed, amidst 75,000 dead, but it is important to step back. 75,000 dead is so many, and I can already see us getting dulled by this as well, just as we've been dulled by so many other things in the Trump era. You know, it was only, I don't have it in front of me. Daniel Dale had a good tweet that was like, here, what Trump has been saying, how many were, you know, ever since he started taking this, you know, quasi moderately, minimally seriously a couple weeks ago. And it was only like April 9th that everybody was saying, you know, 60,000 is the worst case. You know, like it wasn't that long ago. It was only 3 weeks ago. It was only a couple days ago that Trump was saying, you know, 75, 80,000. And then today on Fox and Friends, it's 100, 110,000. And so, you know, I think that there was a lot of kind of Sturm und Drang around the bad models on the high end. But you know, you don't, all the people who are critical of the models who maybe had a point in that regard, you know, many of those same people were the people who were saying 20 to 60,000 dead. And I mean, there's just no end in sight here. And so I think that it's important that we be continually reminding ourselves of that, and of the tragedy around it, because the, you know, the president is just gonna you know, do his you know, kind of spin job on this and keep, you know, changing the number to the extent that it suits him.
So for people who don't live in the world that we live in, the phrase "orange man bad" has become kind of a jibe from the anti-Trumpers, the people. And again, anti-Trump is the people who don't actually defend Trump necessarily, but they will just attack anyone who attacks Trump. It's sort of the Molly Hemingway has built a quasi career out of this. There's a lot of people on the internet.
Constantly Trump opposers.
Yeah,
they're really Trump supporters, but, you know, they're Trump supporters in costume. Costume, so that they don't have to own all of his worst behavior.
And so this is the sneer that when you point out, you know, the latest iteration of Trump's awfulness, they go, oh, there they go. There's Bill Kristol and Charlie Sykes and Tim Miller going orange man bad. As if somehow that's, you see, oh, you're criticizing him. How so last decade or something? I don't know.
And this has been annoying me for a while because these people are annoying. But, it, you know, it really struck through this week when Ben Shapiro, who's a classic in the genre, tweeted, I don't even recall what Biden had done that day that was not good, but, you know, he tweeted a couple of kind of minor issues with Joe Biden. And then, you know, he tweeted about how Joe Biden doesn't really have a campaign motto or slogan. And then, you know, he ended the tweet storm by saying, you know, what is left for Biden besides orange man bad? And that was what kind of prompted me to finally write this article that has been brewing in my head for a while, which is, that is enough. The orange man bad is enough. You know, you can just see in the same ways we were talking about these other things, that the dulling of this, right? That orange man bad goes from a phrase about how Donald Trump is comically immoral and incompetent and idiotic, and comically immoral and incompetent and idiotic in a way that it's not just us deranged Never Trumpers who see it, Charlie. It's they see it. I mean, Ben Shapiro once wrote that Donald Trump does not have the faculties to intend to eat a hot dog. I mean, when he was explaining why he couldn't have intended to trip up Biden in the Ukraine thing, that was his defense on impeachment. You know, I wrote in the article, Ted Cruz in one single day said that Donald Trump was the most narcissistic person in the history of the country. He can't tell the difference between truth and lies, and he's utterly a moron. You know, I get this all the time. I was arguing with Guy Benson about this recently of Town Hall. Who's a good? I think he's trying to do this genuinely and is a good person, but you get so dulled by this that you end up saying things like this. Guy said to me, I think that Donald Trump is actually unfit for office, but I'm still not sure I can support Joe Biden. You know, I'm like, okay, so this person that you got in your own words. It's you guys that are saying that he's unfit. It's you guys that are saying that he is a historic narcissist who can't tell the difference between truth and lies. It's you guys who say that that he is not somebody that you'd want to leave alone with your daughter. And yet you try to dull that to such a degree that you turn it into an attack, right? That it's like, oh, it's silly to concern ourselves with these things. Like, this is something that we've all just known and accepted at this point. The most powerful person, the most important person in the world, with the most significant job in the world, at one of the most significant times in the last half century, is a person who is without character, without virtue, and comically immoral. And let's just now brush past that and now focus on your hypocrisies.
Right, exactly. There's a moment, there's a pattern in all of this where Trump will do something that is indefensible. It is exactly as you describe. And you can almost sense them in that, the anti-Trump world. They sort of take a deep breath. okay, that's really, really, really awful. And they just wait, and then like it's like, you know, the clock ticks, and then they'll find somebody else to attack. Okay, well, let's make this about the media. Let's make this about the Bulwark. Let's make this about the Democrats. We'll find something that they said, so that and then if you're really pressed on it, they fall back on this. Oh, that again, the orange man bad. So this is a great piece. I strongly urge people to read it. By the way, speaking of the cacistocracy. Yeah. As I was running through in my head all the various ways of the worst people in the world, you also have a piece in Rolling Stone about the new press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany. Do I have to learn how to pronounce her name?
I think we're just going to call her Kayleigh.
Okay, Kayleigh. And that's also a great piece because, again, in terms of this pattern of how do the worst people in the world rise in this particular administration, Kayleigh is basically an overpromoted internet troll, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean it's literally what she is.
Literally.
I mean she'd never done anything else. And so, you know, it took me a while to write to your point about how sometimes you feel like you're doing the same thing. I sort of noodled on this Kayleigh article for like 2 weeks, and it was hard to come up with something that I felt like was an interesting thing to say about her, because she is just so transparently a hack, right? It's like, you know, some of these people are at least a hack in interesting ways. I was very interested in Dan Crenshaw the last time I was on. We were talking about that article. Right, he's a hack in an interesting way.
Interesting way, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, he at least tries to think about things differently and has a little bit of shame, you can tell, and tries to come up with creative ways to defend Donald Trump. Kayleigh is just an utter hack, and she had never done anything else in her life. I mean, she'd gone to Harvard Law. That's not nothing. I couldn't have gotten into Harvard Law, so she's obviously smart, but she hadn't had a career at all. You know, I mean, say what you want about Sean Spicer and the Mooch and, you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders. These people had actually done things, right? You know, and Sean Spicer took a pretty traditional conventional path to the press secretary's role. He had been a career spokesman for you know, a Republican campaign, so Republican National Committee for the Bush administration. And you know, he obviously just completely embarrassed himself on day one because you can't be a normal spokesperson for Donald Trump. But his resume and what brought him to the job was pretty conventional. Kayleigh was a blogger who was attending Harvard Law School, who was writing, you know, basically kind of hacky Republican clickbait on the side because she wanted to be a pundit. Like, she aspired to be a pundit. This was her whole career trajectory. And so she would, you know, get guest hits on Fox Business and, you know, kind of weekend CNN in order to pave her way to this. She first, CNN reported yesterday, had the same position that everybody did about Donald Trump, that he was a joke and a racist. But quickly, she discovered that that the path to, you know, getting booked on TV was to just shamelessly defend Donald Trump. Yeah. And so very quickly, she rose from just being an internet troll to the, you know, kind of Jeffrey Lord, to getting the Jeffrey Lord slot on CNN as being the token Trump defender who will defend him on the most ridiculous things possible. And so this is a person who came to the job with absolutely literally no experience in doing anything except for being a hack for Donald Trump. And so, you know, basically what I wrote was that it marked the official end of, you know, this kind of game that everybody had played in Washington that had its faults, no doubt, you know, where everybody kind of, you know, shaded the truth to the best, you know, to a way that best benefited them. But, you know, there were these unwritten rules, there were these unwritten boundaries under which you would argue. And you know, Kayleigh's kind of ascension to this job marks that she is not somebody who has any interest in those rules. Journalistic and establishment is not capable of enforcing them anymore. The party establishments that would have used to, you know, kind of wrap you know, somebody from your own party on the knuckles if they went over the line has no interest or willingness in doing it anymore. And so here we are now, where this new press briefing is just a complete charade, right? There, you know, whereas before, obviously there was spinning and shading of the truth, and sometimes people would go over the lines, but there were kind of these rules and this, you know, kind of understanding that about the importance of the job and the way that you make these arguments, and that's all gone now. And what is left is kind of this charade where there's performative questions asked by the press that they know they're not going to get an answer to. There's performative answers by the press secretary, and then there's performative media coverage of it. There's no point in it.
It's also like a kabuki briefing. Everybody goes through the motions, and we are the audience.
Yeah, and look, everybody knows what they're going to say, you know, at the end of it, right? I mean, you know, CNN knows what they're going to be offended by whatever she says. Fox News knows that they're going to do outrage over the fact that there were mean questions asked to her. There is no value or substantive value in them. It has lost all connection to. What the ostensible purpose of these briefings are, which is, you know, to brief the country about what is happening. Yeah. That has been completely stripped.
Yeah, I've confessed I can't bring myself to watch these things in real life. And, going back to your earlier theme about how we just sort of accept certain things, and I think we've normalized certain things. And, one of the biggest things that happened yesterday, of course, was this whole Michael Flynn story, and which kind of feels like an old news story coming back.
Yeah.
And I guess part of it is as I'm trying to modulate my reaction to all of this, because if you think about it too hard, your head will explode. There were a couple of people who pointed out that, you know, a lot of us have been thinking that the worst case scenario would be that Donald Trump would simply pardon all of his cronies. And the folks around him, you know, as part of the kakistocracy. In a lot of ways, what happened yesterday was so much worse than that. You know, because basically bending the Department of Justice to your will is actually much more dangerous long term than misusing the pardon power. I mean, and that's what's so extraordinary about that. We're all watching this play out in real life. The guy lied to the FBI. He admitted to lying to the FBI. He stood in open court. He pled guilty. And all of these things, all of this is out there. And then the Department of Justice basically goes, yeah, we're going to cut the guy loose.
Yeah, Charlie. And this is another thing that goes back to, you know, something that I wrote in the Orange Man Bad article, which is my guttural instinctual response to this is to believe exactly what you said to be true, right? Like, look, I'm not an expert in how how these sort of prosecutions work and how these reviews work. I try to stay in these, in these sort of podcasts and areas where I, you know, actually know what I'm talking about at least a little bit. But, and so you look at this though, and it is hard to conjure a situation where this dismissal actually happens on the up and up, and you can already imagine and see and anticipate the response of, oh, well, you don't know anything about this, but it's just Orange Man Bad. And this is the point that I made in the article. You cannot judge this administration using the balls and strikes theory, right? Like this idea that you have to put Orange Man Bad over on the side when you look at every happening in every instance is an absurd fallacy. Like the fact that Donald Trump is corrupt, the fact that he is shameless, the fact that he is a person of no character, the fact that he's been a scam artist in the past, all has to be part of your consideration when you look at a situation like this. When everything smells bad, look, maybe at the end of the day, there was one prosecutor who kind of looked at this and didn't like the way that the evidence was gathered. But I mean, how can you give somebody the benefit of the doubt on that when given the behavior of Barr to date, given the behavior of Trump to date? And so, I feel like this is kind of the difference in how, you know, people are looking and analyzing this when they want to take into account Trump's behavior or just sort of pretend it doesn't exist. And so, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it does seem like it could be the worst situation. I'm not certain. One thing I am certain of is this. Michael Flynn was a paid agent of Turkey, a country that is ostensibly an ally, but a very fragile ally at best, and a country that is corrupt, certainly, a corrupt ally, I think would be the best thing that you could say about them. He was a paid agent of them while taking the job as waiting national security advisor, while getting briefings, classified briefings as the incoming national security advisor. He did not tell anybody about this. And then at the same time, amidst an election, regardless of the extent of what ended up happening of the collusion, amidst an election that undoubtedly the Russians helped put their thumb on the scale for Donald Trump or more, he opens a back channel conversation with Russia while Obama was still president. All the legal stuff aside, I'm sure you can have somebody smarter than me on next week to go through all of that. From an optics standpoint and from a corruption standpoint, it's insane that anybody would defend this. It is kind of akin to, Susan Rice, being on the take from the Saudis. I mean, like, who would, or the Iranians? And I guess Iranians is maybe a minor step different because, they aren't technically, they aren't in NATO. But the idea that this is defensible and that this is somehow vindicating is absurd.
It is absurd. I keep thinking about if somebody had to make a movie about the Trump era, who would be the best director? Because it's so much of it, it's beyond parody. You can't make up the scenarios. Your point though about you have to see the pattern. Time did not begin yesterday. We were not born yesterday. Everything is not fresh. It's like, okay, let's look at this in isolation and forget everything we know about this man and who he is. I mean, that's basically part of the balls and strikes problem, is that we're supposed to see things completely out of context, and not bring to bear everything that we know and we've seen over the last 3 years. Okay, let me switch very quickly here. Joe Biden's in the basement, and the president this morning, But what a bizarre, say again, speaking of normalized, here's the morning that we find out that the unemployment rate is, 14.7%, the highest since the Great Depression, 75,000 Americans are dead. And of course, you have the usual Donald Trump being Donald Trump. No empathy whatsoever, no sense of responsibility. And of course, he's making fun of Joe Biden in the basement. So talk to me about Joe Biden in the basement, because that is a thing. That's a problem, isn't it?
I love Joe Biden in the basement. I wish he'd go further in the basement. I think that Joe Biden should go to the heart of Africa on a mission, to try to help a tribe that exists somewhere out where there is no access to communication apparatus. I do not understand this, kind of Catholic guilt that the bedwetting Democrats are putting on Joe Biden, that he should be going out and doing something. Why? Why? Every day that Donald Trump is stepping on a rake is a good day for Joe Biden. Donald Trump is dominating the news, saying completely first lying, offering absurd lies about the nation's response to the pandemic, showing absolutely no empathy, negative empathy, complaining and whining about himself. And he has this huge moment in front of the Lincoln Memorial where he has a chance to speak to the nation. And the big takeaway from this is that he says that he was treated worse than Lincoln. This is not a person that is driving a successful message right now. What is Joe Biden going to do that is going to advance his his campaign any more than just shutting up and getting out of the way? I mean, obviously he can't just hide all the way till November, but I see no reason or no value in him being guilted, out of the basement. And Trump gives the game away this morning by saying, like, I'm going to send Biden, one of these rapid tests, COVID tests, so he can get out of the basement. Trump wants him out of the basement. Trump knows that it is bad when the news is only about him. He needs there to be negative news about Biden to win this election. That's what happened in 2016. That's what he's going to need in 2020. Well, so no, stay in the basement, Joe. Just to actually turn off the camera, I think. He should just do call-ins as well. I don't, nobody needs to see Joe Biden, I don't think, until August.
Well, let's talk about Tara Reid. Tara Reid's back in the news again today. She sat down with Megyn Kelly after dodging all of these other interviews. But there are a lot of folks who are saying, look, there's more corroboration of her story because she mentioned sexual harassment back in the mid-1990s. So what is your take on Tara Reid? How do you think about her?
This has been a really a tough one for me because you do want to just really check your own priors. And I've done... I've done PR work on both sides of the Me Too thing. I've represented women who were blowing the whistle on abusive men, and I've represented a company that, where the founders of the company weren't sexually harassing, but some people on their staff were, and they're trying to figure out how to deal with it. And you do see that, you know, sometimes there are, you know, things you wouldn't expect, right, about how a woman deals with this when they're a victim of harassment. And so, you know, I want to give her the benefit of the doubt. I tried not to kind of weigh in on this, you know, as it continued to evolve until we've learned more. But, you know, there was this really compelling Vox article yesterday that I read by a woman, Laura McGann, who you can tell in the way that she writes it, wanted to believe Tara Reid.
Reid first came
to her over a year ago in 2019 with these accusations of harassment in the office and kind of uncomfortable touching, and that maybe that there were some superiors in the office who said or acted inappropriately, not Biden, but people that she worked for. Basically, the more I've read about this and the more you look into it, what comes into focus is this. Tara Reid told one story for 26 years, from 1993 to 2019. It has a lot of corroboration. The fact that she, you know, felt uncomfortable in the office, by kind of standard Joe Biden, you know, handsiness that he has already apologized and addressed, that everybody sees with their own two eyes. It's just kind of how Joe Biden is. That made her uncomfortable.
Creepy, she not came rapey. Forward with
it. Yeah, creepy, not rapey. She came forward with that in 2019. She specifically said in 2019, and the corroborating witnesses that she provided in 2019 specifically said, this is not a story about sexual assault. So again, it's not like she said that in 1993 and is changing her story now. It's that she said that last year when she first went to the press, a lot of media outlets. Now we fast forward to the South Carolina primary. Joe Biden wins, and within a couple of days, Tara Reid goes forward to pro Bernie Sanders outlets and completely changes her story to one where she was raped. And now in this story, she doesn't have corroborating witnesses except for the neighbor, which I think is the most compelling thing that she's offered. But everything else, you know, all of the other documents, all these other, it's like, you know, Daily Caller tweets like bombshell, new report, corroborates Tara Reid's story. Not really. Like all of the new information corroborates the old story that there was harassment in the Biden office. Nothing else has corroborated this new story. And so, unless she is able to provide a compelling defense for that, or defense isn't the wrong word, but provide a compelling explanation for that, it's just hard to see how this story goes anywhere further than where it is.
No, I agree with you, and I've been somewhat skeptical for some time, and I do think it's legitimate to ask about her political motivations, given the fact that she has changed the story, and the timeline that you just mentioned is highly relevant. The fact that she didn't actually begin to make the allegations of sexual assault until after Joe Biden wins the South Carolina primary. So the fact that she's an ardent Bernie supporter is, I think, at least a data point. The fact that I got caught into this weird vortex about her love affair with Vladimir Putin. I mean, you saw this, right? That she actually wrote some Medium posts that are, I mean, you want to talk about creepy, where she's talking about how wonderful Vladimir Putin is, how sensuous he is, you know, how just wonderful, you know, he is to children and all of this stuff. And she deleted all that. I put out a tweet just basically saying, why did Tara Reid delete this? Okay, and really just saying, you know, what is she trying to scrub her past and the fact that she wrote some just weird stuff about Vladimir Putin? And this is in the category of what are her motivations? What is her judgment? There's actually this one website that actually said that I was insinuating that Vladimir Putin managed to plant Reed in Biden's office back in 1993. And you have guys like David Harsanyi, who has gone full Trump hack over at National Review, going, why are they, you know, raising these questions? These are all legitimate questions. And you know that if you had you know, Blasey Ford or any of, or Anita Hill, you know, had written love notes to Kim Jong-un or to Leonid Brezhnev or to Vladimir Putin, you know that conservatives like Harsanyi and the folks at Breitbart and Washington Examiner and Federalist, they would have lost their shit about this. So
and also just on those guys, just really quick, because Amanda Carpenter had a good article on this earlier this week in the Bulwark. It's just like, well, we don't need to listen to people who spent 5 years covering up for Donald Trump's serial sexual assault, like pretending to be on the moral high ground here. I think that maybe there were some fair arguments on the right about how Reed, you know, there was some bias in how, you know, whether she was taken seriously enough at the start. But it is very clear that as we sit here today, Charlie, like, that argument is for naught. We have heard much more from Tara Reed. She's had much greater opportunity to have a platform to speak out, to demonstrate the truth and the facts on her side than pretty much every single one of Donald Trump's supporters, except for, you know, E. Jean Carroll, who came out after the campaign was over, did. And there are many Trump supporters who've never had any primetime interviews, who've never had, you know, right. There are just so many of them. You know, there was a Washington Examiner person who tweeted at me when I made this point on Twitter. He's like, well, what you're asking is unfair. Like, how could we possibly give all 25 Trump accusers the same platform as Tara Reid? It's just like, what? You know, he's assaulted so many people that we can't cover all of them fairly. At this point, they kind of play this, both sides game with the media where they pressure them into, I think now at this point, giving Tara Reid there's been far more discussion of her and a fair assessment of in the media of what she's put forward than many, many of the Trump accusers who, of the listeners don't even know their names. And so I would encourage them to go to Amanda Carpenter's article and read all their names.
Yeah, I was just thinking if I could name many of them, and I cannot. But I guess the lesson here is, don't tell one lie, tell 100 lies. Don't molest just one woman, molest like dozens, because then people go, oh, that's just too much. We can't actually.
Yeah, there was one of my favorite magazine writers, Chris Jones, who wrote for Esquire, replied to me with this, which is, there's a lesson here. He's like, my father constantly farted throughout my entire childhood all the time, whereas my mother only let out one, and I can only remember the one that my mother did. I can't remember any of the ones that my father did. So there's the lesson.
There's life lessons. People listen to the podcast. Yeah. So what do you make of, what should we make of the strange new respect we're getting from James Carville? You know what I'm referring to.
So happy that you asked this, because I have a text from James Carville that I was going to bring up at the end of this. So we're, okay. You know, it's just, he's
this
our,
is awesome.
He's okay. Our BFF at this point. Live text coming in.
But he was on MSNBC and on a podcast with Al Hunt, where he was in even more going on about the Bulwark was doing the kind of thing, because we're so mean. I think he was referring to you, obviously. We're so mean that we know how to fight, as opposed to the Democrats, and people need to go to the Bulwark, and because the Bulwark is actually, you know, pounding Donald Trump. So is this, first of all, true? I mean, that's high praise coming from a puncher like James Carville. Although I was saying to my wife yesterday, can you imagine if, you know, a few years ago somebody said we'd be listening to a podcast with James Carville and listening to him talk? I mean, it's so weird. But he knows about punching. He knows about fighting. And his main theme is, says nice things about us, but saying that Democrats aren't doing this. I think the question is, why are the never Trumpers landing the hard blows and drawing blood, and not the Democrats? What's the Democrats' problem?
Yeah, my other good anecdote of Carville for our fellow LSU fans is when we talked, he said to me, thank goodness that this pandemic happened after that national championship game. So now we can be champions for love for longer.
Okay, that's like, what's important. Yeah. I'm a Milwaukee Bucks fan, so this doesn't
run. Yeah, it doesn't land as well. I don't know. Look, obviously, all of these things are shades of gray. I think here's an example of this, though. If you look at the Bulwark's landing page when it comes to the coronavirus and COVID-19, you can see that we, from the start, from very early in this process, have been, I think, willing to say the truth and to go there about how terrible Donald Trump's response to this was. For whatever reason, I do think that it took the Democrats have now kind of come around and are making many of the same arguments we were making in early March, but... Yeah. Whether that's cautiousness. Yeah, sure. Right. Exactly. Look, it's not as if the Democrats are like afraid to attack Donald Trump. I don't think that's true. But I think that Carville's point is that they have other considerations at play sometimes. They were fighting their own primary. Right now, I think the Biden campaign is more worried about ensuring that the Bernie crowd doesn't create trouble during the fall than they are about kind of focusing on hitting Trump and reaching out to our crowd. That's a strategic choice they're making. I'm not really criticizing it. I'm just saying that they have these considerations that we don't, and I think that we're free to kind of be able to let our freak flag fly, because look, at the end of this, we're not angling for a gig at Treasury, right? We're not angling for getting back in the Trump White House. Like we have the freedom of having no attachments here, and so I think that that is probably what
the freedom of no attachments and no future whatsoever. So
yeah, exactly.
Great.
Wonderful.
Okay, so can I make a point about pro-lifers,
please?
Okay, so I've said this, but I want to flesh this out because among the many shocking things that we've experienced over the last couple of years, watching conservatives become part of this cult of personality and switching their positions on a lot of issues, what's happening now with the party of life becoming kind of the death panel party is really one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen. And I'm thinking about the Bethany Mandel tweets about, call me Grammy killer, but I'm not going to inconvenience myself, by staying home, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she got, royally ratioed for that, which of course she deserves. Anybody who's spent a lot of time, on the internet know that there are some people who are sort of notorious for bad faith arguments, but this the way in which you have pro, and I'm specifically talking about pro-life conservatives, have bought into this, if it's economically inconvenient and socially inconvenient, we may have to sacrifice tens of thousands of lives. Because if you substitute abortion for that, that I'm not going to inconvenience myself economically or socially or anything, people would recognize, the problem with this. But I keep thinking of my experience, and I've mentioned this a couple of times. Here in Wisconsin, for about a decade and a half, I was every year, except for one or two, I was the master of ceremonies of the Right to Life Dinner, the Wisconsin Right to Life Dinner. I actually bailed out one year because, believe it or not, this was pre-Trump, when Laura Ingraham was the designated speaker, and I didn't want to introduce her. So I took a year off, but that was me,
That was prescient, actually.
Yeah, it actually was. Although I probably should have bailed out the year that they had Michelle Malkin come as the speaker. Ugh. So I mean, that's on my resume. But I remember going to, and I would go around the state giving speeches on Wisconsin Right to Life, for Wisconsin Right to Life. And one of the ones that I remembered was in the before 2010, shortly after my mother died, very very suddenly. I was going, she left, a lot of stuff behind, including this, this green tin box, which survived. She actually died in a fire. I don't want to get into it, but so there was not everything that survived, but there was this green box that survived. And in this box were all of the records and the correspondence from her first husband, who had been killed in 1943 in Sicily during World War II. He was her high school sweetheart. And he'd gone on to be a captain in the U.S. Army and won the Silver Star. He was an incredible hero. I mean, he actually led an attack against German anti-aircraft guns that had been lowered to basically, you know, aimed down at the troops, and he led the infantry assault against them. But anyway, he was killed. And she kept every single piece of paper, including the letters that she got from the general that he was missing in action, you know, all the insurance papers. And I remember just thinking, you know, the value and the impact of one human life, how it changes so much, and how when you know, obviously, had he lived, I probably would never have been born, to be quite honest, but because, she, of course,
right.
she married after. But the value of this one human life and how it impacted her life and how important it was. And you think about, you know, when a child falls into a well in Texas and on all the TV cameras, remember those stories, you know, mm-hmm. can we save this one child? And it becomes a big deal. And I was talking to this one Right to Life group about this, this inherent understanding of the value that each person had and why we take that right to life so seriously in the entire culture of life. And I remember being one of my, I mean, it meant a lot to me to make that point. And I got a lot of reaction to it, but now I'm watching so many of the people who would have been in that audience going, yeah, but I want to go to Arby's. And yeah, I understand lots of people are going to die, but you know, it's inconvenient. I mean, that, you know, my 401k is going to lose money if we don't put grandma at risk. And it's like, really, I understand the mentality, but I don't understand the mentality from you because you know better. And so this is one of these disillusioning moments where you wonder, does anyone actually ever believe anything? I'm sorry, that's my rant.
No, it's a good rant. I can't do anything as pointless as Caitlin Flanagan's Atlantic article that you shared. Yeah. And it was so good on this. And I just would direct readers to that about her experience as a cancer survivor and kind of projecting about being told essentially that, you know, she is expendable. You know, by the open it up crowd. I'm of two minds of this, Charlie. On the one hand, you know, putting on, you know, my technocratic, you know, centrist policy hat, like, all the time the government makes choices, right, based mm-hmm. on True. Kind of actuarial choices, right? Like, you know, there's just not there's not unlimited funds and not unlimited ability to save everybody all the time, right? And so, you know, I understand the argument that's being made by good faith folks on the open it up side that there's certain things we need to do in a smart way that might, you know, increase the risk quotient a little bit, but also, you know, is going to benefit, you know, the economic pain that is real and people are suffering. I get that. But the dismissiveness, to your point, like the dismissiveness of the argument that many people make, and the cruelty and just the, you know, kind of crass sense that, you know, to just kind of dismiss the notion that arguing in defense of saving one life is even a serious argument or is even a rational argument from people that made this argument for years, it is striking. And it is something that was stuck with me very much when it came to the argument about, you know, kids on the border and the refugees, right? I mean, the pro-life party is going to zero out the refugee numbers in America. And that's something that I'm never going to be able to get past. And, you know, kind of to bring us full circle, I think would be purposely obtuse to not wonder, you know, what impact Trump had on this and whether you know, where is the cause and the effect here of our bad orange president, right? And did he rise through the pro-life movement because it was something within our culture that had already broken, that they could, you know, elevate somebody that had just utter and complete and total disregard for every single life except for his own to the most important job in the world? Or was his, you know, did his success kind of dull the sensitivity to that among his supporters? You know, did his success kind of convince them and enable them to think that actually You know, maybe I should be thinking about this in a more selfish way. Maybe the way that I'd been thinking about these things in the past was wrong because, you know, these, you know, weak cuck, never Trumper pro-lifers, you know, always got run over by the media and by the left. Maybe there's a little bit of both, but I it's hard to just ignore that.
Well, and also that this cultivated callousness that we don't care. We don't care. And this has really become part of the culture.
It's tough to not care. It's strong to not care.
Right. It's exactly that. It is the embrace of the coarsening effect of all of this. So people have to go check out the Bulwark, Orange Man Bad Is Bad by Tim Miller. And of course, the piece in Rolling Stone about Kaylee and appreciate it very much, Tim. I hope you have a great weekend. Thanks for spending time with us on the podcast.
Charlie, anytime. Go Tigers.
And thank you for listening to today's Paul Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.